Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail bro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Boys that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, nbpp.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Wonderful introduction and welcoming everybody. Once again, welcome everybody. It's great to have you join us for this exciting presentation. My name is Veronica Finn Brewery. I am a co-chair of the Africa Interest Group of ISIL. And I am so ecstatic to see the wonderful and amazing speakers we have today. This program has been months and months of planning, and it's just so amazing to see all of us gathering in one place today. And I want to say personally thank you to Professor Carl Burrows, to Professor Rhoda Hassman, and to Professor Mario Nisbet and Christina Parker. It's so amazing, and I thank you so much for making the time, and I want to also appreciate Genna for taking this time to moderate the session. So Genna, the floor is yours. Let's do it.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. I am Genna Diasenjing, and I will be your moderator for this event. Now, just a brief introduction, the transatlantic slave trade is one of the worst crimes against humanity in our history. And for over 400 years, about 12 million enslaved Africans were transported, bought, sold, and owned by other humans as legal property across the Americas, Europe, and the Caribbean. Since the abolition of slavery from the British Empire and the United States, no redress or reparations has been provided for Africans affected by this dehumanizing trade. Today's panel aims to address three major topics, the first being reparations for the injustice against enslaved Africans and their generations. The second, reparations for Africans traumatized by the effects of slavery. And third, the process of healing between Africans affected by slavery around the globe. With me, I have four very amazing and knowledgeable people that will be doing presentations over the course of the next hour, 30 minutes. I will introduce them before their presentations, one after the other, the first being Dr. Rhoda Howard-Hassman. Dr. Howard-Hassman is Professor Emeritus at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada, where from 2003 to 2016, she held the Canada Research Chair in International Human Rights. She is the author of Reparations to Africa, which was published in 2008, and related articles, including her most recent article of 2022, Should the USA Offer Reparations to Africa for the Transatlantic Slave Trade? The link to this article will be provided in the chat for anyone who's interested. But without further ado, Professor Hassman, the floor is yours.
Good morning. Sorry, I was muted. Today I'm going to talk from my 2022 article. I'm going to give my own recommendations of what the U.S. should do for as reparations to Africa, not African Americans, to Africa for the slave trade. And I'm also going to compare this to the Belgian Commission on Reparations for Colonialism, about which more later. So I believe, first, that the U.S. should support a truth commission on the slave trade. This truth commission should discuss who conducted the transatlantic trade, who was enslaved, and what were the effects on Africa and the West. It should cover from the beginning of the U.S. slave trade to the end of the illegal trade, which was approximately 1860. It should discuss African and Arab enslavers, as well as American enslavers. It should be organized by a reputable organization such as the UN and should include African, American, and Arab commissioners, as well as scholars and activists. Its summary should be widely distributed and accessible. And I'm arguing this partly because only an authoritative truth commission could serve as a good background for negotiations between the US and Africa. Especially this truth commission should address questions of how the slave trade underdeveloped Africa, a question first posed many years ago by Walter Rodney, and how it developed the U.S., first posed many years ago by Eric Williams. It needs to address this question without absolving African leaders since independence of their own responsibility for underdevelopment. This will not provide any definitive answers, but it will narrow the range of permissible lies, as Michael Ignatieff once put it. Then I think the U.S. owes an apology to Africa. The absence of apologies from African slave trading societies or Arab societies does not absolve the United States from its own need to apologize. So far, Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush have acknowledged the evils of the slave trade, Clinton in Uganda in 1998 and Bush in Senegal in 2003, but there's been no apology. This apology has to be between equals, for example, from the U.S. president to heads of state in the African Union, or to heads of state of countries for which large numbers of slaves were taken to the U.S. This now can be determined from shipping records and genetic databases. And then there should be a second formal apology within the U.S., in order to educate American citizens about the trade. Apologies, the wording of the apology has to be agreed ahead of time between the U.S. and African recipients of the apology. It has to be held in a ceremonial venue, and the U.S. president has to present genuine remorse. Normally, an apology includes a promise of non-repetition, but this is not relevant now since nobody's going to repeat the slave trade. But it also has to include a promise of some sort of compensation. So the question is, to whom should we give the compensation? And I am recommending only symbolic financial compensation. So it could be given to the African Union or to countries from which large numbers of slaves were taken. It could be used to fund the Truce Commission, to provide commemorative and educational projects about the slave trade within Africa, to maintain African museums and historic sites of the trade, and also importantly, to fund educational and commemorative projects within the United States. Now, realists would say, why would we bother with this? And one answer might be to diffuse the politics of resentment against the West, to improve relations between the United States with the African Union or specific African countries, and in general, to build trust. But criticisms would say things like, the slave traders were not our ancestors, which is true for many Americans, but as the late Kenyan-American scholar Ali Masrui put it, if you get the benefits of citizenship in the United States, then you also have the responsibilities of citizenship, including reparations. But in fact, as we know, white support, even for reparations to African Americans, not Africa itself, is very low, 16% in a 2019 survey. Furthermore, large-scale reparations would face all the problems of foreign aid in general, such as wastage, corruption, mismanagement, and lack of capacity to administer the aid properly. Critics might also argue that there are more important problems, such as poverty and climate change. Further realist assessment would say, on the negative side, there's no strategic reason now for reparations. African resentment of the West has no strategic effect. No other world power is pressuring the U.S. for reparations to Africa. And African nations, even collectively, are not strong enough to threaten the U.S. However, the new multipolar world we're now in, especially with China as a power, might affect U.S.-Africa relations and make reparations worthwhile. Now I'd like to talk to you a bit about the Belgian Commission on Reparations. Belgium is more advanced than the U.S. on reparations and has established a parliamentary commission on reparations for colonialism in Congo, Rwanda, and Burundi. There was no Belgian participation as such in the slave trade because Belgium didn't actually become a country until 1830. But we know about Congo's status as the so-called private property of King Leopold II in the late 19th and early 20th century. And we know that what sociologists call a mass atrocity crime, or a crime against humanity, was committed there with the murders and maiming of millions of Congolese. So the Belgians, first of all, commissioned a huge report. It's over 640 pages by Belgian and African historians together, single-spaced. It's unfortunately published in French and Dutch-Flemish, but not in English. The commission also held a testimony via Zoom by about 80 experts worldwide before representatives of the various Belgian political parties. So I presented my testimony on July 8th last year, 15 minutes testimony plus questions. And I was asked to testify only on the question of symbolic reparations, so I read about 20 pages of the report in French. And I believe this is all going to be made available via the internet, but I'm not sure how that will be done. So my recommendations were similar but somewhat different to the ones for the United States. Again, I suggested that Belgium offer apologies to the three former colonies because this would render relations between Africa and Belgium more equitable and might contribute to psychological healings for both parties. I should say that for my book, Reparations to Africa, my research assistants and I conducted 74 interviews with Africans, and this is one of the things they said about apologies. Again, Belgium should draft apologies in consultation with the intended recipients, apologize separately to each former colony in a ceremonial venue, and publicize the apology widely. But I am concerned with the problem of legitimizing authoritarian rule and legitimizing the people who are currently in power in these three countries. So I'm wondering whether there's another way to apologize without actually apologizing to people who are heads of state, illegitimate heads of state, in my view. With regard to Truth Commission, this huge report is already a Truth Commission, but it has, of course, to be summarized, simplified, and widely publicized. For symbolic material reparations, there was a big discussion in Belgium about access to archives previously held public, so privately rather. Belgian Catholic entities have already agreed to open up all their archives, but a particular concern is the archives of Belgian mining corporations in Congo. So I think that all public and private archives should be opened and private entities should be compelled to open up their archives, whether they like it or not. I suggested an annual National Day of Remembrance, something like the Martin Luther King Day, although I'm not sure it should be a holiday because then it just becomes like a three-day weekend. It might be better to have remembrance ceremonies at schools, government institutions, and so on every year. I also recommended a national year of reflection by state, sub-state, and non-state entities on how they could make material reparations, just as is happening in the U.S. now by some universities, some corporations, and some municipalities. For example, corporations could institute employment and training schemes for both Africans in Africa and in the colonies and Africans in Belgium. There could be targeted scholarships, again, for these people. The government could support research chairs within Africa on Belgian colonialism, and universities could collaborate with African universities, not just on the history of colonialism, but also in training people in STEM subjects, which is badly needed. I also recommended for education a year-long project to educate both Belgian and African citizens about colonialism. This happened in the UK in 2007 on the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade, when there was a year-long education and commemoration project. These could include more memorials and educational plaques in Belgium, and in Africa, more support for museums, memorial spaces, and public educational projects. So that's it. Thank you very much. Here's my email, hassman@wlu.ca, especially if you would like access to my, if you would like a copy of my testimony to the Belgians. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hassman. And just to let participants know that we have a Q&A segment, which would be at the end, but you could send in your questions at the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. Our next speaker is Dr. Mario Nisbet, who is a current visiting assistant teaching professor in the Department of African American Studies at Syracuse University. His home institution is the Center for African and International Studies at the University of Cape Coast in Ghana. Having taught in other universities in the United States and Kenya, his publications are available in journals such as Symbolism and Contemporary Journal of African Studies. Dr. Nisbet got his PhD from University of California at Berkeley and is the author of The Workings of Diaspora, Jamaican Maroons and the Claims to Sovereignty. This work will also be provided in the chat for anyone interested. Dr. Nisbet, over to you. Dr. Nisbet, you're muted.
Okay, yes. Can you hear me now? Yes. Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for the introduction. And also thank you for the invitation. And I like to thank all of the organizers that put so much work in putting the conference together. So I'll start with my short presentation. It's titled Reparations for the Transatlantic Slave Trade to Africans as a Means of Reconstituting Global Humanity. So I will start with the point that the crisis, we are facing a crisis in the global, in the world right now, and it's related to having an unsustainable global order. Our main forms of, our main models of development is destructive to humanity, and it's also unsustainable. Even visions of a green world is built through unsustainable technologies. For example, if we look at solar panels, the technology used to build solar panel, the solar panel itself comes through unsustainable technology. So the technology that's supposed to be sustainable is being built through sustainable technologies. And if we look at the wider context in terms of US as a model of what the world should look like or what the globe should look like in terms of development, the US is only 4% of the population, but we use up about 20% of the world resource. And so in a sense, if we want the world to be like how the US is, we would need five planets to accomplish this. And I'm arguing that the origins of this current world order was birthed during the time period of the transatlantic slave trade. And the transatlantic slave trade is a crime against humanity. And this impact of the transatlantic trade slaves still continue to be a crime against humanity. And as Eric Williams talks about in Capitalism and Slavery, slavery led to the further development of capitalism and led to the further development of industrial revolution. But at the same time, this also led to the creation of race and the creation of black people as being inferior and in terms of justifying slavery itself. So whether through colonization or colonialism, countries in Africa, in the Americas, even in Asia and parts of Europe, these modern states and the international system was formed by white supremacy, or at least the foundation of white supremacy during this time period. And the transatlantic slave trade also ties slavery to Africans. So as we know, up until the 18th century, Africans weren't the main people enslaved in the world. Other people were enslaved in the world. But because of the transatlantic slave trade, slavery has been associated with Africans and people of African descent. And it created, in turn, created a global hierarchy where true white supremacy, that the Africans are supposed to be at the bottom and the Europeans supposed to be at the top. And this order have led to the dehumanization of Africans that still continue today. We see today in many different forms, whether it's police brutality, whether it's invasions or conflict. We see a lot of that remnant of this geopolitical system of Africans at the bottom not able to get full rights apparent in our globe. So this is why the call for reparation or reparative justice is important, especially at this crisis point we have in the world. In defining reparation, I'm using the UN definition, which is reparation should not be only equated with financial compensation, but it should include restitution, rehabilitation, acknowledgement of injustice, apologies, memorialization, educational reform, guarantees that such injustice won't continue, as my colleague before me mentioned. So in terms of reparations, it should include all of these things, but it should also include reworking the global system that was actually created at a very early modern period with Africans become enslaved linked to the transatlantic slave trade. But this would also include climate change, and I also think that this needs to be a conversation not only among Africans, but among Europeans and actually among the globe. So in concluding, basically, the impossibility was done in terms of genocide, slavery, and colonialism. So I think that is for us to come up with ways that create another impossible world, a world that seemed impossible with the current crisis that we face in the globe and in the world, and the situation that we have. It would be very difficult for humanity to continue to live in the way that they are living with the geopolitical system changing. I think it's an opportune time to really have a discussion about reconciliation in the world that is not necessarily, you know, although financial issues important, it should be also includes changing the system that created the great inequality in the first place. So if we go to the past, we correct the past, we work on the present, but we also work on the future. So reparations could also take the form of not only monetary compensation, but also maybe perhaps fair trade. Like, for example, in Ghana, where I currently teach, since I'm a visiting professor here in Syracuse, the global market dictates the price to Ghana in terms of how much they must sell their cocoa. If we're talking about reparations, we should talk about how about having some fair trade, African having voices in not only the United Nations, but the WTO in terms of transforming the relationship in the globe. So I always tell my students that we are not, people usually say that we are destroying the planet, but I tell my students we are not so much destroying the planet, but we are destroying our capacity to live on the planet. And we are destroying the ability for our children to continue to live on the planet. And only through global dialogue about the injustices that have been done in the past and having an honest conversation about where we go in the future is something that we need to do. And reparation, I think, is center in that argument. So I'll end here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nisbet. Very interesting presentations going on. We have Dr. Christina Parker-Shandell next, who is an associate professor in social development studies at the University of Waterloo in Canada. As a restorative justice practitioner and researcher, she focuses on how dialogic pedagogies facilitate inclusive spaces where all students can participate and have their voices heard. She holds a PhD in curriculum studies and teacher development and a master's of teaching from the University of Toronto. She is also a certified teacher in Ontario. She is the author of Restorative Justice in the Classroom, Liberating Students' Voices Through Relation Pedagogy, which was published in 2022. She's also the author of Peace Building, Citizenship and Identity, Empowering Conflict and Dialogue in Multicultural Classrooms, which was published in 2016, and co-editor of Finding Refuge in Canada, Narratives of Dislocation, published in 2021. I will be linking her website and some of her work in the chat for you. Dr. Christina, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. I'm really happy to be here participating in this conversation on the transatlantic slave trade and reparations to Africa. At first, I wasn't quite sure how my work would fit in this panel, but as I think about my work and so grateful for the previous presenters as well in terms of your thoughts about what it means to create healing and possibilities for young people is where I'm positioning my work, particularly for Black youth who suffer from being pushed into what I'm going to talk to you about today as what I frame as the school-to-prison pipeline. And I'm going to discuss both the origins of that injustice and how we can create possibilities for transformation as a way to facilitate reparations. So I just wanted to start with this story to sort of set the stage of how I position this work. And in Ibram Kendi's book of How to Be an Anti-Racist, when he was in school and as a Black youth in noticed how all of his teachers, the white teachers, but in this one particular example, would often pick on the white students when they raised their hands, even when the black students raised their hands. So he remembers this one incident particularly when he was sitting in the back of his classroom, and he noticed one of his black female peers who didn't often raise her hand. She meekly put up her hand to be called upon. And although she was the first one to raise her hand, the teacher didn't choose her. Instead, the teacher opted to choose a white female student who was frequently called on and who sat at the front of the class. So he describes this moment of observing this peer of his as she slowly put her hand down with hunched shoulders, her obvious feeling of withdrawal, feeling shame. And he remembers this feeling of rage, and knowing and seeing exactly what happened was because of race. But as a young person he was, how was he supposed to articulate that complaint? He didn't have the power, privilege, or language to lodge it. Assembly, he took his seat in the auditorium with his classmates, but when it was time to go, he refused to. He stayed seated, and when he was told to line up, he just refused to listen to the teacher and instead just stayed in his seat looking straight ahead. The teacher didn't crouch down beside him and say, "What's wrong? You know, you seem upset. This isn't like you. How can I help you?" Instead, the teacher chose to call the principal, who then called their parents and then threatened him with punishment, eventually removed him. This wasn't because he was a defiant student. It was because there was a rage that was ignited in him. It was because of him that occurred, but he was unable to do anything about it. So he questioned why the teacher didn't ask him what was troubling him. Research has shown that if a student of color and a white child go to the office, there's a higher chance that that student of color will be met with a more severe punishment, suspension instead of detention, missing recess instead of an apology, being yelled at and told what they did wrong instead of asking the simple question of what happened and how can I support you. So if you're a child and you're continuously being pushed out and witnessing exclusion in the classroom, in the hallways, in your community, the question rises of, you know, is there a higher chance that that child would go to prison? The research says that the answer is yes. When schools enact punishments that purposely work to target marginalized students, particularly Black students, the impact on those students' learning and engagement is compromised. And when they're unfairly targeted, these students are more likely to skip school, disengage academically, or drop out altogether. In this way, rendered powerless, marginalized students as they are left with few tools to advocate or support themselves, and such students often end up with less earning potential, and their potential for ending up in prison increases. So clearly we can see that these exclusionary and punitive punishments cause many negative impacts, both for psychological and physical well-being. So a present-day carceral system of inequality traces back to the hierarchy created through the slave trade. Ronaldo Walcott writes in his recent book on property that the ownership of Black people persists today. He says that possession has had to be something more than ownership. So it also became authority invested in white people to deflect all inferiors. This meant that even when a white person did not actually own slaves, he or she still possessed authority over Black people, whether enslaved or not. So in a post-slavery world, this cultural attitude persists. As both of the previous presenters pointed out, white people continue to maintain the sense of superiority. The social construct has come with the expectation that Black people will continue to practice the sense of subordination in a number of different ways. And the pipeline, as I refer to it here in this presentation today, represents those kinds of policies and practices that help facilitate that, that help facilitate pushing young people toward imprisonment over the course of their lifetime. It doesn't start or end there, though. It persists, and some people refer to this process as the cradle to prison pipeline, looking at the systemic and structural oppression that begins at birth. Also, little attention has been paid to what happens post-incarceration. So just to go over a little bit of the origins of the pipeline, many so-called discipline practices function as a continued form of control or oppression. So for instance, zero tolerance policies are disciplinary practices that require automatic and severe punishment for certain types of behaviors, such as fighting or possessing drugs or weapons. The problem is that they don't consider the individual circumstances or intent. And these policies have found to disproportionately affect students of color, as well as students with disabilities. Next, over-policing and criminalization. So many schools rely on law enforcement to address student misbehavior. Some schools constantly have a police presence that are particularly targeting certain students as well. Other students have designated school resource officers. This often results in students being criminalized for minor infractions, such as being arrested over a slight disruption in class or for being late. Again, students of color are much more likely to be targeted. And racial and socioeconomic disparities continue to impact students of color and those from low-income families, since they are more likely to attend underfunded schools that don't have adequate resources, mental health support, guidance counselors that are culturally responsive particularly. These students are more likely to face bias and discrimination from educators and school administrators that are constantly putting Black students in a state of surveillance. And then this all leads, finally, not all-encompassing, but some of the examples to school pushout, where students who are constantly expelled or suspended are more likely to drop out, more likely to become involved in the criminal justice system and experience negative long-term outcomes. So considering all of this, it's important to note that the causes of the school-to-prison pipeline are very complex, and addressing the issue involves a very comprehensive approach. It involves changing policies and practices in schools, law enforcement, the criminal justice system, as well as a commitment, a societal commitment, to addressing these issues of inequality and discrimination. So we've heard about different types of theories about what can be used to mitigate and interrupt the school-to-prison pipeline. I have my view on certain principles, and we'll share it today. Restorative justice in education is a concept I reference a lot in my work, and I believe that restorative justice is critical for healing from the African slave trade and from the intergenerational trauma that it has had on Black people. Speaking from a North American context, I believe that restorative justice is relevant to interrupting this pipeline, because restorative justice is a way in which it can actually, one, facilitate healing, but also create spaces for dialogue so people can share their views, they can talk about what has happened, and they can potentially process that trauma together. So one, in classroom context, we can see that students could become engaged on social issues that impact them on their communities. Two, become equipped with tools to manage conflict constructively. And three, are able to come together in community to proactively build and sustain strong relationships. And really, a question we can ask ourselves is, you know, are we creating a generation or investing in a generation of graduates that can be engaged citizens such as this, prepared to navigate exclusion and bias, as well as prepared to navigate the status quo? So as someone who has spent a considerable amount of time doing classroom-based research, I believe that restorative justice is one way in which we can open up space for inclusion. So one critical tool that's used with restorative justice is a peacemaking circle. It has its origins in Indigenous worldviews and Indigenous community practices that emphasize people's interconnections with the world. So circles, at a very basic level, are when students are seated in a circle facing each other and are given the opportunity to talk. The person with the talking piece has the right to speak if they choose to, and everyone else has the responsibility to listen as the talking piece goes sequentially around the circle. So this format encourages students to actively listen to one another, sometimes have to deal with conflict in a more proactive way, and it provides everyone the chance to speak if they would like to. So it's a simple yet powerful process. Many organizations and communities use peacemaking circle processes in conjunction with the criminal justice system. So in my work with youth diversion programs, I facilitated circles as an alternative for youth who are going through the traditional criminal justice system. So some youth think that, oh, if they have diversion, they would initially come into the circle thinking it would actually be easier than going through court. However, almost always, they say it was a much more challenging process. And it's challenging because they actually had to speak instead of sitting behind a box while someone spoke for them. And they had to hear about how their actions may have impacted one another, but also talk about what was going on for them that led to those actions. So in most cases, that dialogue that occurs in the circle not only transforms the outcome of the conflict, but it transforms the individual as well. So my research is focused on classroom-based practices of restorative justice, and the literature is very clear in terms of its outcome, that engaging in this kind of dialogic process would teach and support people to communicate effectively and safely and facilitate safe spaces for learning. So I just wanted to bring this visual for to help us better understand what restorative justice in education could look like in schools. And it's conceptualized by Kathy Evans and Dorothy Vandering, where they talk about how restorative justice in education could promote accountability for one's actions, foster healing, and nurture relationships. These three pillars represented here are just and equitable relationships, conflict transformation, as well as nurturing and repairing relationships. And these tenets here emphasize at the heart of it all, that people are worthy and relational and deserving of respect and equity. So the increase in the popularity of restorative justice, as you can see in terms of a lot of writing and studies that have been done on it recently, is really indicative of a shift in consciousness toward believing that exclusion does not equal justice. You know, restorative justice speaks back to the punitive white supremacist frameworks. It presents an alternative platform to engage with young people where educators and admin could really reframe their misconceptions about student rebellion and thinking that how can we actually see those concepts of when students are potentially rebelling, but actually looking at it as productive behavior, because those students are not acting out as they might be called. They're actually, if we look at it as they're hurting out and they're processing that hurt and trauma, and they're coming to school as a way in which they can potentially heal. So equipping teachers and administrators and school personnel with tools to understand racial justice and what it looks like in the classroom as well as in disciplinary forms is critical to enriching the lives of students who have been unfairly targeted. So I just wanted to give a quick example in my study of restorative justice in the classroom. I found that many of the students felt that their participation in circles allowed them the chance to speak and be heard. One male student of color said that he really enjoyed this process because he had the chance to speak to most people in the class. In another classroom where there was a lot of clique culture that led to very divisive connections and rigid boundaries, it really helped to facilitate community. And there was one Black female student who had been frequently sent to the office. And in an interview with her, she said to me, quote, "When we go to the office, it's like we don't even get into trouble. They just talk to us and ask how we're doing. I don't even know why they bring the person you fought with to sit right beside you. But as much as you don't want to talk to them, you've got to, and it actually makes things better," end the quote. So I asked the principal of this school what she thought about the fact that some of her students were describing the office as a place they go to when they don't get into trouble. And as expected, she saw this as a compliment. She said, quote, "Well, yeah, of course, because that's what we want. We bring them down here and we want to know how they're doing and we want to help them feel better. We do that and then we don't usually see them again, or at least not as often," end quote. So, you know, thinking about this and the possibilities for to Kendi's experience, you know, I wonder how it might have differed if he was in a school that was committed to a restorative justice culture. So considering all of this, and because we know the power of dialogue, I think that if we invest in training educators, community leaders to practice and prepare young people for these dialogic opportunities, it could have lasting impacts for promoting and honoring our democratic society, and especially in the context in which we are speaking about today, is a critical process for engaging in healing from the impact of slavery. So many people think that restorative justice is only about making sure kids don't get suspended and that they graduate and that they don't end up trapped in the school-to-prison pipeline, but it is much more than that. And to me, it's about implementing these equity-based programming that I've spoken about today. So I believe that this work involves healing, and it's an all hands community approach. It involves teachers, social workers, law enforcement, community service professionals. So, you know, when we're looking, they're not top down. They're really, you know, bottom up strategies that involve thinking about how we can acknowledge that non-racist is not anti-racist, that we really have to think about ways in which to use intentional action to decolonize approaches, to name the genocide, displacement, replacement, and profiting that occurs under settler colonialism. My version of restorative justice, as I've talked about it here today, is not about control. It really is about pedagogy and questioning, you know, what are we using schools for? What is the intention of it? And what are we going to do? I recently published a book that came out last month, and it's focused on how to build a kind of relational pedagogy that I described today, and how we can use an anti-racist approach to use restorative justice. I'd also recommend Colorizing Restorative Justice for those interested in learning more about this approach. So just to close, I wanted to share this quote from Miriam Kaba, who writes about transformative justice and abolition, who says, justice is the ability for people to get what they need in order to lead dignified lives. So thank you so much. I think I will pause there and look forward to questions and discussion at the end.
Thank you so much, Dr. Christina. That was an amazing presentation. We have one more person to go before we take questions. Just to remind participants that you can use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen to send in questions for the panelists. Last but not least, we have Dr. Carl Patrick Burrows, who is a historian and thought leader working in the U.S. and Liberia. Dr. Burrows?
There we are. Thank you for the presentation. I think I'll do one slide at a time. Thank you so much for the introduction, and I would like to extend my appreciation to the organizers for the invitation. Before I begin, I want to make it clear that in putting this presentation together, my goal was not to affect the emotions of anyone. And, you know, we're having conversations now about presentations on history, making individuals feel bad or responsible for wrongdoing. And I have relatives and friends in Florida, so I hope to be able to visit them. I don't want to be, you know, excluded from going to any of those states that have imposed those restrictions. The point I'm trying to make, though, is that we need an honest accounting of the impact of the slave trade on Africa. And from there, we can decide how we proceed. But it's important to have, you know, the assessment of the impact. So the transatlantic slave trade was responsible for the removal of 12.5 million, it's estimated, African captives to the Americas. Others died en route to the Americas, both on the continent and on the Atlantic. From 1492 to 1820, most people don't know this, but five times as many Africans landed in the Americas as did Europeans. I'm so sorry about the loss of... Okay, so I apologize for that. So what I wanted to present was a screen showing some of the areas of Africa that were most impacted by the traffic. And as you can see, places like Benin, Biafra, the Bight of Biafra, the Gold Coast, and certainly West Central Africa, Angola and the Congo were heavily impacted. And now I want to look at, present to you the literature, the historical literature regarding the deleterious impact, and there were various of the transatlantic slave trade. In one context, we could talk about the cultural impact, and one result was alcohol abuse. Prior to the traffic in West Africa in particular, there was fermented palm wine, but that was replaced through the slave trade with distilled liquors, especially rum. And rum in particular was critical here because it was used as a kind of currency along with guns for the purchase of captives. By the late 1700s, about 750,000 gallons of rum were being sent from the Caribbean and New England. And by 1860, it was up to about 6.1 million gallons. The cultural aspect of the trade, the impact it had, often isn't discussed, but these are some of the dimensions that we need to capture if we're going to have a full understanding and appreciation of the consequences of the trade on the continent. Psychologically, one impact was distrust. Obviously, the hunting and selling of humans left a deep and abiding sense of distrust among Africans. Research shows that distrust is highest today in areas of Africa where the slave trade was most intense. Trust, it should be noted, is an indispensable foundation for economic prosperity. It's a form of social capital that is important for economic progress. Another psychological dimension, which Professor Nesbitt alluded to in his presentation, has to do with the ongoing, longstanding inferiority complex. We need to remember that one justification for the slave trade was that Africans were subhuman. And that meant then we lacked humanity. You know, there were several dimensions of what it means to be human that was considered to be absent from Africans, but present in the people in the West. So Eurocentrism sanitizes Western history while patronizing and even demonizing the non-West. It presents the West in terms of its noblest achievements, science, progress, humanism, but of the non-West, it presents it in terms of its deficiencies, real or imagined. Africans have imbibed this worldview, and it affects not only our relationship with the West, but our sense of self and what it is we're able to accomplish. So if we consider the psychological dimensions to be important, one of the questions that have to be addressed is how then do we propose to unravel the inferiority complex that has become ingrained. Another dimension that tends to be overlooked, a consequence of the slave trade, is gender inequality. I apologize for the typo. Initially, when the traffic began, more men were exported than women. The demand was for men. This resulted in a gender imbalance, which helped to entrench polygamy. Women then took on tasks previously done by the men who had been removed. The multiple wives who entered into these polygamous relationships were acquired mainly by the privileged sellers of captives because they were the ones who now were the most successful and powerful within these communities. Politically, there was a power shift that occurred as a consequence of the slave trade. Wealth and power flowed to the kidnappers and sellers of captives. What many don't appreciate when we talk about African traditions as if they're timeless, unchanging, what we don't often take into account is that earlier structures of political and religious authorities were altered and in some cases destroyed because of this traffic. The economic dimension, which often is what comes to mind when people talk about impact and potential reparations, and the economic impact involved the transfer of labor, but also of skills, which again, the skills aspect tends to be overlooked. So Africa lost 15 million people, if we include those who died en route, but in the process, skills were transferred, including rice growing and metal smelting, to name a few. The smelting of iron in Africa, West Africa in particular, was considered by Europeans to have been superior to what was available, the technology available in Europe at the time. But what the West had was coal deposits, which fueled the manufacture of iron on a large scale. But Western visitors to Africa would have their tools repaired, iron tools and so forth, and would remark on the advanced nature of the knowledge and technology at the time. So rice growing was fairly common in a large swath of West Africa, beginning from the Senegambia area, of course, all the way down through to Liberia. Initially, the slave ships would be filled with rice as a means of feeding those who were being brought to the Americas. Other staples had been tried initially, tubers, yams, cassavas, and such, but those tend to spoil. With rice will keep until you add water. And so initially rice was being bought on the coast, but it was decided at some point that instead there should be an effort to capture Africans who had rice growing skills, bring them to the America, and place them in areas that were swampy so that they then could grow rice, and the rice seeds were brought, you know, as well. West Africa went from an exporter of rice to an importer by 1761. That imbalance remains. Africa is constantly importing rice as we speak. Overall, what we face is a form of arrested development. In the year 2000, per capita income in Africa was about $1,834, compared to $8,809 for the rest of the world. A scholar who studies the economic impact suggested that 72% of the average income gap between Africa and the rest of the world would not exist today, and 99% of the income gap between Africa and other developing countries were it not for the slave trade. So but for the transatlantic slave trade, Africa would be on par with Asia and Latin America. What I have at the end of the presentation are references to sources that were used in putting this together. And anyone who's interested, I'd be willing to share them with you as well. But as I end, I really would like to make this plea for those in the audience and beyond, that we consider the discussion of the transatlantic slave trade much as we would other crimes against humanity that we freely, widely discuss. You take the Second World War, for example. There's no masking the fact that, you know, there were, the war was begun by the Nazis in Germany, and that it wasn't all the Germans who were responsible, but it was a system that was in place in Germany at the time. And then Japan entered on the side of the Germans. We have those discussions. The American war for independence would make no sense if the role of the British, you know, empire wasn't considered. And so in schools, the involvement of the British and the fact that the war was brought upon, you know, in part by the demands from the empire, the colonial power at the time, those are widely discussed. But it's when we come to the transatlantic slave trade that there's a tendency to say, assessing the consequences somehow or the other is an encroachment on other people's sense of self and their ability to feel as if they're not being blamed. So thank you. I'll end it there, and hopefully we can get some questions.
Thank you, Dr. Burrows. We have a question in the chat. I've noticed that Dr. Hasman responded, but I do believe these responses are private, so I'll just read it out, and Dr. Hasman, you could unmute and answer the question. That way, all of the participants will be able to hear the answer. The question says, if there is a concern about legitimizing certain leaders in Africa, could the apology be made directly to representatives of the ethnic and linguistic groups who were impacted by the slave trade? Dr. Hasman, you're muted.
Yeah, there I go. I thought that was an excellent question, an excellent suggestion, which hadn't really occurred to me. The other advantage of that would be that slave trading ethnic groups within Africa, such as the Ashanti in Ghana, would then have a precedent to apologizing for, to apologize to the groups within Africa from whom they took slaves. So it would be a better specification of who was likely to actually have been enslaved if apologies were offered, as this person suggests, to representatives of the groups most likely to have been enslaved. May I reply to Dr. Burrows for a moment for his excellent presentation? I'd just like to note, Dr. Burrows, that several European countries have indeed acknowledged that the slave trade should have been a crime against humanity. I mean, legally it wasn't, but should have been considered a crime against humanity at the time, and that we now consider it a crime against humanity. But those countries will not go as far as apologizing. They simply make that acknowledgement, and they leave it at that, so far as I know so far.
All right, I'll just add one more follow-up question for you, Dr. Hasman. My recent research focused on truth commissions, and I realize that you mentioned it in your presentation. However, some of the criticisms of truth commissions are that they are basically dependent on the will of governments. How do you think this will play, even if a truth commission is set up to investigate what happened during the slave trade?
Well, of course, they're dependent on the will of governments. One thing that we're not even talking about is the 10 million people taken by the Arab slave traders. And I think the reason for that is that the Arab countries are not democracies. Possibly people are less concerned because the Arab enslavers are brown people, not white people. But of course, it will depend on the will of governments. The U.S. Congress has voted so far for a commission to study whether there should be a commission on the slave trade, on slavery within the United States. That's as far as they've got. They haven't even said we should have something in the United States yet. Obama himself vetoed it originally, probably because he figured people would be too angry at him as a black president for suggesting there should be a commission to study the effects of slavery and Jim Crow and post-Jim Crow in the United States. All these things depend on governance. Of course they do.
Thank you. Dr. Nisbet.
I would like to comment, if I may, on the point made by Professor Howard Hafson.
Sure, go ahead.
And I would suggest that there is a discussion going on among scholars, and there has been a discussion regarding the Trans-Sahara slave trade. But we wouldn't necessarily expect to see that discussion enter into the context of societies like this, associations like this in the West. So what often happens is that issues that affect the West are discussed in the West. But I think it's unfair to suggest that we aren't having that discussion about the Trans-Sahara slave trade because of race. And I think that the discussion is there. The scholars have been, historians have been assessing the impact on Africa. Among Muslims in West Africa, there's been discussions, longstanding and growing about the differences, between Arab Muslims and the consequence of the Trans-Sahara slave trade, et cetera. But that's a discussion for another day. Well, I think that the key thing is that we're having this discussion at all, after centuries. And there's precedence for reparation in that reparations were paid to the slaveholders of the West Indies by the British government. Reparations were paid by the Haitian people who liberated themselves. They had to pay reparations to the French. And then suddenly we get into this discussion of the possibility of reparations to Africa and, what is offered instead are apologies. So I think, we want to be sure that we are looking at this historically, looking at the precedence that has existed. And I would just add that we need to do it fully because there is a growing body of work on the Trans-Sahara slave trade and its deleterious impact.
Thank you, Dr. Burns. My next question is for Dr. Nisbet. You're from University of Cape Coast, and I think Ghana in general and Cape Coast have done a pretty good job with memorialization and keeping some of the castles to educate young people about the history of slavery in the country. How do you think other countries in Africa can sort of use some of these mechanisms to also educate our young people so that they know what the history is? But not just people within Africa, but other people that come to these countries, let's say from Europe and the Americas, to see firsthand how people have been impacted and how the slave trade did happen back.
I mean, I think, I'm originally from the Caribbean. I was born in the Caribbean, right? Thanks for the question. Originally born in the Caribbean, but I I was born in the British Caribbean, a British colony, and then I moved to the U.S. Virgin Islands, which is like a U.S. territory. And it used to also be a Danish colony where a lot of the enslaved Africans actually came from the Gold Coast. So I'm a full-time lecturer in the Gold Coast, but I think even in Ghana, I think that the conversation is coming up more, and also I think they need to have more of a conversation because the castles, even though the castles and the different things, they're usually in Ghana, the idea is that when people come to visit, the idea is that we go to the castles and my current department where I'm working in the Center for African and International Studies, the director of the department also make arguments of that the Africans that came, that went to the Americas, often they didn't come from around the castle themselves. They came from much further inland. And also what is, you know, like we need to do more research actually in the communities that they came from. But also to, there's different dynamics too. Like to sometime, at least in Ghana with my students, sometimes the idea is that the slave trade negatively affected those who were enslaved and went to the Americas. But oftentimes I bring up the conversation that we had mothers, we had fathers, brothers and sisters actually lost their family members. And, you know, I try to make them think about, like, imagine if your brother just disappeared, your sister just disappeared, or if you even have children and you were not able to protect them, you know, what kind of damage is done? And as also my colleague raised in terms of the psychological effect, you know, you have, you know, ripple psychological effect on the continent. And to me, one of the biggest issues was the issues of distrust, you know, like in terms of distrust. And I think that even increased the instability. And he also raised the argument of like, also the issues of African, are they complicit? So like in what happened? And so it's something that I'm actually grappling with, because many of the states that in many ways that were victim of the transatlantic slave trade, they themselves, you know, also, you know, were involved in it, but there were no country in Africa that wasn't negatively affected by the slave trade. There was no territory that I think didn't lose members from their own society. So the issue to me is a question of, are we blaming the victim versus did Africans fully participate in it with full, you know, autonomy in the sense of, or was it a race to the bottom where this group is able to get grants quicker than I am able to, and if I don't get them, then the other group would be able to conquer me and I lose my people. Like, so it's something I'm grappling and thinking about, and it's something that I try to raise with my students, and I think it's becoming more of a conversation as we discuss more things about it. But I haven't visited much countries in West Africa, so I'm not sure of the level of the debate there, but I think it's important to have this debate internal and external.
Thank you. I see Dr. Bruy wants to make a comment, and actually there's a comment in the question box about what you just mentioned. Is it really a trade where Africans were willingly participating in, or was it facilitated by the Europeans and the Americans who sort of created this market and deemed Black people as lesser than they are? Dr. Bruy, you can make your comment before I move on to the next question.
Yes, thank you. Without taking much away, because I see some really fascinating questions in the Q&A, and I really hope everybody can get to it. I just really wanted to make a quick point on Dr. Nesbitt's response and, you know, the question you are asking in terms of Ghana and Cape Coast. From my subjective experience, you know, as a Liberian, I know, and a person who lived as a refugee in Ghana where I went to school, I actually did my A-levels in Cape Coast at Infantiman Girls, right near the castle that you were talking about, Gina. And I also recently taught at the University of Cape Coast along with Dr. Nesbitt. So my limited experience as a student growing up in both Liberia and Ghana, there seemed to be a huge disjoint, and Professor Burrows can attest to this. We don't grow up learning about the transatlantic slave trade in our educational system. It's not sustainable. And it was just amazing listening to Dr. Hassman talk about, and Dr. Parker talking about how we can really, not just for the West, but as Africans, we also need to consciously incorporate this into our educational system. We go to the castle, we learn about the dehumanizing experience, but then there's the disjoint when we get back to school. We don't really learn about it. They don't really teach it. And even up to university, I went to University of Ghana, and bless his soul, Kwame Nkrumah instituted the African Studies Program for all African students that go to the University of Ghana. We weren't taught the transatlantic slave trade and how it impacted upon us as Africans
on the continent and our generations for us in Liberia. So I just really hope this conversation get wider and very important, as Dr. Nissa is saying. We need to really engage in our institutions back home, not just abroad. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bruce. Dr. Christina, I like that your presentation sort of drew parallels on how basically white supremacy and slavery still plays a role in our learning institutions. How do you think some of these things could be platformed better for people that say slavery happened so many years ago and that people should just get over it and move on?
Sorry, I didn't hear the last part of your question.
I asked, how would the parallels of slavery and white supremacy and how it affects Black children in school, how do you think it could be platformed better to sort of respond to comments that slavery happened so many years ago and that people should just get over it and move on?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I think that that's how schools are really set up in many ways, that they are presenting the sense of neutrality in a way to signify that things have changed and that's not the way it is. And however, I think because when people are not paying attention and are actually enacting these behaviors and are so oblivious to it, whether it's part of like the hidden and implicit curriculum and the ways in which the history is taught or not taught or glossed over, it really is troubling. And I think oftentimes people think that it can be solved through thematic periods, through, you know, having Black History Month or putting a Black author on the reading list or, you know, in terms of Indigenous communities wearing Orange Shirt Day, but that's really not enough. You know, we really have to think about how do we critically think about, you know, what we are learning, what we are teaching and with whom we are learning with, and really reflect on that. And really, again, thinking about the intentional action through critical race theory in classrooms. We need to use culturally responsive methods. We need to really continuously be naming how we can center decolonizing approaches in the classroom that name the displacement of Africans around the world and the ways in which settler colonialism continues to persist, both in the curriculum and in the pedagogy as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think we have time for a couple more questions. There's one in the chat and someone talks about how slavery basically is sort of ignored by the UN system, even within international criminal law, as it's not provided for specifically as a crime against humanity, and how recently trafficking of persons is what they've been using to or define as modern day slavery. Does anyone want to comment on that? Basically the UN system and how it has intentionally kept slavery out of the discussion.
No, I can comment on that if I may. May I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Slavery was outlawed under international law in 1926. That's just a fact. I mean, it doesn't mean that slavery stopped, but it was outlawed as of 1926. The International Criminal Court can only deal with matters which took place since 2002. The treaty to establish it was in 1998. It only came into existence in 2002. So it doesn't have any remit to look at historical crimes, much as we might like it to. So you are right that in part it's trafficking in women now, but there are other kinds of slavery, such as slave laborers, which is a very common practice, unfortunately. But these legal mechanisms can't deal with historic crimes. The best we can do is say that should have been considered a crime. But it wasn't. Slavery was legal at the time, unfortunately.
All right. Does anyone want to comment on that before we ask another question? No? All right. Dr. Burrows. I'm thinking of this from a development point of view. What we're seeing is that a lot of African states still feel the effects of the slave trade and are sort of stagnant when it comes to, well, not stagnant, but very slow paced when it comes to development as a result of slavery and colonialism. What would your comment be in terms of Western governments that still impose some neocolonialist rules towards African countries in terms of aid or helping in development?
So I think that any steps forward, right, need to be rooted in a proper assessment of what the impact was. And that requires reviewing the historical literature and such. But I think we also need to take into account important differences that exist between countries in the West and those on the continent. Countries on the continent did not exist at the time of the slave trade. Those states that existed, those polities that existed prior to the emergence of this traffic ended up being destroyed in part by that traffic. So new entities emerged in part because they were facilitating the trade. And then subsequently, you know, colonialism just built upon the remnants of the transatlantic slave trade. And there was no effort or no opportunity for recovery by Africans. And the states that we have now are the legacy of colonialism in many respects. On the other hand, in the West, there has been continuity since the time of the slave trade. There are institutions that benefited or were implicated that continue to exist up to this point. I think that we need to recognize those fundamental differences, because when we talk about, you know, reparations as such, it's, for me, hard to argue for the expectation of reparations from entities that only recently emerged, whereas insurance companies or banks or, you know, other institutions that clearly we can document were involved and derive some of their wealth from this traffic. They occupy a different space, a different relationship, legally and otherwise. Yes. So those are my reflections.
Thank you. We have a question in the chat from Emmanuel, who basically is questioning how important this discussion is. And do we need to have this discussion just within academics in Africa, or does it need to move to the West? How seriously do you think the West is taking this discussion on the transatlantic slave trade and the need for reparations for Africans and people of African descent? Anyone can like answer on that.
I mean, I could answer that. I think that it's important to have the discussion in Africa. It's very important to have the discussion in Africa. And I think it's because if you look at the population, I feel that the transatlantic slave trade affected Africa and people of African descent. Most people of African descent, they live on the continent. 90% of people of African descent live on the continent of Africa, while 10% also live outside of the continent. So the continent, I think, is very important in the discussion, but I also think that how are you defining the West? Because the reparation movement is very strong in the West. So I think if anything, the conversation needs to be more even so on the continent, because it's strong in the Caribbean. It's strong, especially the Anglophone speaking Caribbean. It's growing in Haiti. It's very, I think it's strong in the United States. And the Dutch government said they would give reparations. You see people in the UK, also individual families talking about reparations. So I think the movement is strong and it's growing. So I think it also need to grow in Africa, where Africans are coming more on board to discuss reparations.
If I may?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
I think that the movement for reparations is definitely growing and is very strong in the Caribbean. The problem is when you ask who's taking it seriously, and the answer is not the government of the United States. I mean, we're a long way, as I said before, from reparations to African Americans, let alone reparations to Africans themselves. The former Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, went to the Caribbean and just said, no way. Even though the Caribbean demand is quite reasonable, it's for what is the equivalent of the reparations to slave owners in the Caribbean in 1834. So I think it's up to something like £12 billion in our money. That seems quite reasonable, but Cameron just said, no way. So unfortunately, it's not yet, I think, influential enough to get reparations, except possibly for these small symbolic kinds of things, which maybe you will get. I mean, the city of Amsterdam, for example, apologized recently. I don't know. Dr. Nisbet says the Netherlands apologized, I think. I'm not sure about that. I mean, I didn't see it myself. I'm not questioning him. So the question is, how seriously do the people who really ought to pay the reparations take it? And the answer is not much.
I have to look. In terms of the Dutch, I saw it in a newspaper report, but I have to look to find out exactly where I sign. But I think the reparation movement in the United States, in terms of the government, I think they are not taking it seriously. But if you look at Georgetown University, Harvard University, Evansville in Illinois, you look at Rosewood, you look at Tulsa, they have been reparation given, and it's symbolic and it's not significant, but there's some movement there, I think, in terms of institutions maybe, but the government itself, yes, the U.S. government itself is not taking it seriously, but you have movements in different states, including California, where there's a lot of discussion about reparations. So I think it's growing, but the government, yes, I would agree with you, the government isn't taking it as serious, but I think in time they will start taking it more serious as people raise issues, and I think as geopolitical system change, I think that will come up more.
Yes, to respond to your question, I would say that I think it's necessary for the conversation to take place in all of the relevant spaces on the continent, in the U.S., in the Caribbean, et cetera. But I agree with Professor Nesbitt that there's a need for much more to be done on the continent itself for the reasons he stated. I would also want to quote Frederick Douglass, who said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. And so it is through these discussions that the demands build, and that they then can register with the governments, you know, that are currently not taking the question of reparation seriously. And I'll remember personally, the organizing to end apartheid in South Africa and the role of students who called for divestment from on the part of their universities from, you know, companies doing business in apartheid, et cetera. And initially it seemed like a pipe dream, but it grew. And eventually the pressure, you know, came to be brought to bear. So I'm optimistic in the long term. Okay, pessimism of the mind, the Italians say, but optimism of the spirit. And I think the discussions will fuel that process, especially in a world that we're seeing now that is bipolar or multipolar. The chances or better.
Thank you so much. I see we are almost out of time. We have one more minute. I want to take this opportunity to thank all of our panelists for taking the time to make these wonderful presentations. I'm sure everyone has learned from them. We still have a few questions coming in, but unfortunately, we do not have time for it. You could reach out to the panelists at any time, and I'm sure they will be happy to answer your questions. Thank you so much for having me as a moderator. It has been an honor and a pleasure. And until the next program, have a wonderful day and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you, everybody. It was so great. I'll be in touch again directly. Thank you so much. I've learned so much. Thank you, everybody.
Into the papers, let's quickly explore what they have for us. And we'll start with the Daily Graphic newspaper, but let me announce that we'll be joined shortly by media consultant Liz Hafron-Asari. Okie doke, so we start with the Daily Graphic newspaper. Fight insecurity, SECOM urges African leaders. And of course, the very first time that a Ghanaian is back becoming head of the Catholic Church in Africa, so to speak, His Eminence Richard Cardinal Kouya Bawober, President of SECOM. I'll bring you some details of that story on page 16. We also have law school entrance exams, prospective students to sign undertaking. That's according to the General Legal Counsel. And this statement has stirred the hornet's nest because it's got a lot of people talking about why students have to sign an undertaking of this nature. Yesterday, interacting with Suleimana Brahima, Executive Director of the Media Foundation for West Africa, I actually read this undertaking that students have to sign. You sign away your rights to get any retallying of your scores. You sign away your rights to basically seek any redress, any form of redress on the back of this exam. You don't have the right to even know what the pass mark is. And I ask, especially as a student of law myself, some people are afraid in my position to talk about these issues because guess what? They feel they'll be victimized, but someone must bail the cat. So the question is, to my former dean, Dina Tuguba, to whom Professor Kweku Asari has addressed that question, and the others on the General Legal Counsel, how can it be that you have an exam and nobody knows what the pass mark is? And so what? It's discretionary, it's unilateral, it's at the what? Behest of the powers that be. So at, in any given year, for example, the General Legal Counsel could decide the pass mark is 70% because this year so many people have crossed the 50% mark and we don't have enough space. While in previous years, by and large, it has been 50%, and it's all discretionary. How? How can we have that? When I attended the University of Ghana as a postgraduate student, there were different phases. You sit the entrance exam, you have to pass two essay questions, you have to write some sense, they'll check your grammar, your analytical skills, your knowledge of current affairs. Then you get to the next stage, where, you know, it will be whittled down, then the interview stage. Why can't we have a system where people know that, look, this is what it takes? Fair. I mean, they determined, even when I was entering the University of Ghana Law School or faculty, they determined the pass mark, which, well, maybe not too many of us knew, or nobody knew. But how can we sustain such a system? Not at our primary level, not at the basic level, BECE, not at the SHS level, not at the university level does that apply. But once it gets to law school, then all of a sudden everything is a haze, misty, very vague, ambiguous. Why? You know, it's a question really our legal system must address. And I'm wholly for what Professor Kweku Asari says. I am blunt. I say it as it is. It makes absolutely no sense. Just a control mechanism. And in the meantime, you have the likes of Kenya, Rwanda, all of whom didn't have law schools when we got our law school, courtesy of Kwame Nkrumah. And these very people who today are the elite, the luminaries, when it comes to legal education, went through that system without any hurdles. Yet, look at how we've turned the system into. It's heartbreaking, really. And like I said, I really don't care who feels offended, whose corns feel treaded on. The truth is the truth. As an old vandal, truth stands. Anyway, I'll be getting into that story as well, but reparations for Africa, long overdue. I have quite some thinking on this as well. While I feel, yes, like the Benin bronzes that are being returned, artifacts that were looted that are being returned from Germany and Belgium recently, the tooth, the only bit that was left, only fragment left of Patrice Lumumba, after the Belgians, you know, oversaw that he was killed, his body, you know, dissolved in acid and all of that cruel way of dispatching somebody. But apart from that, yes, maybe, yes, reparation, I agree. But I feel with what we've had, how long ago has it been since we hit independence? And I see you, Liz, I'll be coming to you shortly, but I'm just giving vent to some thoughts this morning. How many years have we been independent in Ghana? 65. Within that period, what have we done for ourselves? Within this period, we should have done enough to prove to the colonialist powers, the imperialists, that what Kwame Nkrumah said was true, that we can man our own affairs. Yeah, we're manning our own affairs all the way to the IMF. Yet it's Sikaso. So why can't we make something out of the Sika we have? We have it all. All right, Liz, a very good morning to you.
Good morning.
I get passionate about these matters because as a young person looking, sometimes you go to other countries and you look at your own country and you feel irked. Your spirit is provoked because you look at us like, you know, mention was made a short while ago about Cuba, right? Cuba has been under an embargo since the, 1950s, since Fidel Castro and his people came to power. And all the way till now, stiffer under Donald Trump, being eased up a bit now. But they survived. I have lived in Cuba. They've survived to the point where these antique vehicles, people travel to Cuba just to watch them. They realized they didn't have much, so they capitalized on tourism. You should go there and see what they're doing. We have everything, yet. Your quick thoughts on that, and then we can talk about legal education. Nothing in this country makes sense to me anymore.
Necessity is the mother of invention. So if you look at Cuba, because they are closed, they know that they have to develop, they have to find a way out for themselves. They're not depending upon anybody but themselves. So they work at what they have, and they sustain and keep what they have. And so if you look at Cuba looks like it's heaven on earth because they've done everything for themselves. Again, when you're open, like we are, and talk about free trade, and then you have this globalized world where it has become like a village and everything is being thrown at you. You're not close like Cuba is. So you're accepting everything left, right, center. You're not producing anything for yourself. And therefore, instead of going forward, we seem to be going backwards because when you produce something in Ghana, your cost is so high, you don't know how much you're going to sell it for. And then again, we have developed ourselves into a people who believe that anything that comes from outside is better than what we have. And so when we are looking at quality, we are looking at quality with regards to what is produced in America, in the UK, and Germany. And we are not patronizing what we are producing ourselves. But if you don't patronize what you're producing, then your producers don't get enough money to be able to improve what they're giving you in the first place. So again, we shoot ourselves in the foot because if you go into a shop and you see something that is made outside and there's something that is made in Ghana, you're likely to pick what is made outside because you think that it's of better quality. But they have done it so because they have bought their own things over time, and so their factories get better and better. we do not patronize our stuff, so our factories do not get better because they are always cash strapped. And if we don't look at that and we don't avert our minds to patronizing what we ourselves are producing, we won't go anywhere.
Mm. Well, just a bit of that story for those who are watching us. So page 16, on the law school entrance exams, critics, including lawyers, law students, and some civil society organizations, have poured scorn on the decision, of course, which has created a heated public discussion. That is to have this undertaking not to challenge the results of the examination. However, those in support of the decision think the GLC is being practical owing to the limited space in the Ghana School of Law compared to the overwhelming number of Bachelor of Law graduates who want to enter law school to read the professional course. So what this simply means, Liz, is it's not that you are not qualified. It's not that you don't know enough. It is just that because we have a paucity of space, we're going to do everything possible to eliminate you in whichever way possible. And for me, that is mind-boggling. It is fatalistic, and it is even unpatriotic because, like I'm saying, in other countries, you know, one thing that even makes this entire saga so nauseating, the point that I think, is it the Upper East or the Upper West? There are about three operating there in an entire region. There is such a shortage of legal brains to handle cases across the country. Yet we have a system that has created some sort of ivory tower-like, you know, place where it is just for a few people. And, you know, if I keep on, I think I'll just explode, so I'll leave it there. I do not know. Some of our leaders across different, you know, facets of our society, sometimes you look at decisions, it just makes you, it's like the whole decision about the SIM card re-registration. Let me bring that in. You want people to re-register. Okay, not a problem. Register people. You want them to re-register. Okay, that's fine. Now you create impediments because you want them to re-register only with a certain Ghana card. And a lot of people don't have this Ghana card through no fault of theirs. Next thing you know, you now want them to pay 5 CDs for something that has nothing to do with them, something that they did not create. I mean, why is it that in this country, everything must be queue, long queue, go stand, bake in the sun? And for me, the most heartbreaking part, elderly people, that is what I see that even, you know, racks, you know, my heart. Elderly people, 70, septuagenarians, you know, octogenarians and stuff, baking in the sun, sitting for a whole day, people who are supposed to be productive at work just because they are afraid you will, you know, block them out of the system. To what end? Makes no sense. Makes no sense.
I asked one question when I went to re-register my phone. And my question was, how do you take my fingerprints with a camera? What kind of a camera are you using? And so I questioned, and the lady just looked at me because she didn't have an answer. Because you just put your finger there. She uses her phone, and I'm like, do you have my ID card on your phone? And she's just looking at me. So I registered one phone and decided I won't register the other. If they'll block it, they should block it. And I intentionally did that. And the one that I did not register is the official phone. So let's see what happens. Because they are not giving us answers to certain questions that we are asking. I thought that if you needed my fingerprint, I would have to thumbprint or fingerprint something. Because I don't see how you're going to get all those lines in my fingers with your camera. Unless it is a highly sophisticated camera, and I didn't see that.
Well, we'll see how things go. The latest we've heard, though, is that people are now, you know, some of them take quick loans. I hear, depending on how long you've been with the network, you can take up to 2,000 Ghana CDs and others. And some people, though I am not in support of that because the system has worked, but some people have also taken loans and they're saying, okay, you want to block us out of the system, block us, block those chips, and I'm not paying back. But, I mean, that is also, on the other side, criminal, so to speak. But it just tells you that when people hit a brick wall, it's like bouncing a ball against the wall. It'll come back, right back at you.
Now, let me go back to the lawyers. And I have said time and again that I'm surprised that our Ghana Law School has not expanded yet. Because like you said, you're talking about the Upper West that has only three lawyers. And then you have people saying that we churn out so many lawyers and what do the lawyers do? If you churn out lawyers and they choose where they want to work and they choose where they want to stay, then you have a problem like this one. So you realize that in Accra, we might say that there's a concentration of lawyers. And then when you go outside of Accra, you don't have that many to attend court as regularly as you want them to. But I think that over the years, I've seen the same number of lawyers being trained till lately. And for me, it was a good thing that you have more people wanting to read law. Because if you have a lot more lawyers, if you have people understanding our constitutions and our laws and our acts better, and being able to explain it better to the people, then you know that the people are working within a certain permit, because they understand what they need to do. They understand the issues when it comes to law, because you have a lot more people who can explain it to them. You have a lot more people that they can go to. But we are not seeing that. And when you talk about them trying to exclude certain people, then it becomes very worrisome for me. Because if you're taking a certain class of people and you're not taking a certain class of people, are you sure that the class of people that you're taking will go out into the rural areas to work? And so we need the law school to grow. We need the law school to expand. It's good that a lot more people want to read law. I never wanted to read law. I thought that my family had too many lawyers and too many judges. So if I needed anything, I could fall on one of them. But it's good, especially for those who are outside of Accra, especially for those who do not understand the law in its totality, especially for those who sometimes do certain things and question why you think that they've done it wrongly or why they're out of the law. If you're not explaining the law to the people, how do you expect them to be able to abide by them? So I think that we need to do a lot more work when it comes to training lawyers and dealing with our laws and explaining our laws for the ordinary people to understand. We all know that we have a constitution. How many people have the constitution? How many people understand the constitution? So we know we want to vote for people to go into parliament, but how many of us understand what they're in parliament for? And that I would always be at their doors knocking and asking for money to pay school fees and things, because we think that they're in a position to be able to get that money to help us. And so we need to go real down and make sure that every region, and now we have 16 of them, have enough lawyers that will help the citizens, because that is what they're here for.
And just as I move on to the next story, just one thought that I missed. Again, why can't we have, you know, with the executive MBAs and others, so you have weekend classes, weekend sessions and all of that, or evening sessions. Why can't we do that? So another area of concern in there is they force the system. If you want to read law, you must necessarily stop work.
Exactly.
Stop work. How do you fund your education? If you wanted to, look at me, for example. So you want me to stop what I'm doing, come and do law, and maybe come back here, and you expect that, you know, the slot would still be open for me. I mean, the dynamics are, sometimes you sit and think about it, and you ask, who are these people thinking in these places? I'm sorry, I'm being very blunt. How?
No, but
in today's world where you don't stop one thing and just move on to another, people are combining multiple things. You want me to just stop my work, uproot myself, how do you expect me to pay my school fees and all of that? Final thoughts there, and let's move on.
Over the years, we have built lawyers into a class of their own. And so you're privileged to belong to the law fraternity, if I should put it that way. And so they see a lot more people joining them as watering down what they have. But again, that is not what we are looking at. It's not your status that we are interested in. if the education of the people, is the education of the citizenry, is the building up of a nation that understands its laws, so that it can work within that if you don't have people understanding, that's why we'll have our prisons crowded, because nobody's explaining anything to anybody. And a little misdemeanor and they throw you into prison. I mean, we should go beyond that. I even said that the prison system should be expanded such that little misdemeanors, you serve like, what do they call it?
Community service.
You do some community service to make up.
Well, I think recently the president assented to plea bargaining, I think. So
yes.
Now there are going to be some mitigating factors so that people can have some breathing room.
We should have had that long ago instead of us sticking to one stringent rule of doing things when it comes to the law. And again, when you're talking about people who are working, right now law is like a second degree. You're looking at people who are working, and yet you're expecting them to leave their work and come study. And so who fills in those spaces? And when you finish reading your law and you want to go back to where you're working, you think your employers are waiting for you. They must have filled it up. And like you're saying, why don't we find other ways of training lawyers rather than just have the Ghana Law School that everybody has to go through? There are other faculties of law that have come up with Zenith and Gimpa and others. But when you finish with those, you definitely have to go through the law school. And the law school has not gone.
Other stories. Let's do some business-related stories quickly and move on. Non-traditional export earnings hit $3.3 billion in 2021. That is an increment from $2.84 billion in 2020 to $3.33 billion in 2021. It represents an increase of 17%. Now, the performance is associated with economic recovery post-COVID-19 on global trade, which the WTO forecasts to expand with double-digit numbers. I see forecasted in the daily graphic. Forecasted. So, which the World Trade Organization forecasts to expand with double-digit numbers. It's like saying broadcasted, which we often, but broadcast. Anyway, so that story, and then graphic business.
The printer's devil.
Is it a printer's devil? Really? Business, graphic business. Industry wants say in IMF negotiations, and the Association of Ghana Industries, AGI, has expressed readiness to partner the government to negotiate a good deal with the IMF to help accelerate the recovery of the country's economy. And then again, interest cost wipes off 55% of tax revenue. Inflation, CD fall to blame. Let's do the Ghanaian Times newspaper list. On page 17, which is the banner headline, VEEP inaugurates 100-kilometer rehabilitated Kumasi roads. Military officer dies of monkeypox in Bolga. That's a sad development. I think outside of Africa, listening to the BBC yesterday, I think only four people have died, but within Africa, quite a number. Resolve issues surrounding LPG supply to end tanker driver strike. That is COPEC Ghana appealing to government. And transatlantic slave trade in Africa. President demands apology compensation from European nations. Let's focus on page 17 on the issue of LPG drivers and move on. So the Chamber of Petroleum Consumers Ghana, COPEC Ghana, has urged the government to immediately resolve pending liquefied petroleum gas issues with industry players to restore supply of the product in the country. It said the Ghana National Tanker Drivers Association, liquefied petroleum gas marketing companies, and the Ghana Liquefied Petroleum Gas Operators Association had withdrawn their services effective yesterday because their concerns had lingered for long. A statement issued in Accra yesterday by COPEC Executive Secretary Danka Amoa said, consumers would continue to bear the brunt as all LPG outlets remain non-operational. So touching on the genesis of the problems, just to give you more scope, Liz, it said, the MPA said, after the atomic gas explosion about 5 years ago, the MPA and its former chief executive, Hassan Tampuli, directed the freezing of the permits of a number of stations under construction. Several years down the line, this ban is yet to be lifted, thereby leaving the various company who had invested heavily in the construction of these retail points heavily debt distressed, as they are constantly harassed by their banks and other finance entities who have advanced various loans to put up these stations. So again, policy. Something catastrophic happened. In fact, I was in the neighborhood and I felt what had happened then, the explosion. On the back of that, you put in place measures to regulate, mitigate the situation. What do you do ahead of that or after that? Put in measures as well so that these people don't lose out. All you need to do is ensure they are in compliance. But here we are. We're resolving one problem and creating other problems at the same time.
And I am here thinking, how long has this gone on? Again, I can feel the pain of the drivers and those who are involved in LPG distribution, because if for several years your source of income, let me use the word advisedly, is being toyed with, then you'd want to find out what exactly is happening to you. And when you talk about people's debt not being paid, and they're not being productive, so they can't really pay their debts, and so the interest is accruing. So you'd owe the banks far more than you envisage that you'd owe them. But again, then your job too is on the line, because you're not producing or you're not doing as well as you expected that you'd be doing. So all these questions are running through my mind, and you said, yes, it's back to policy, and why has government waited so long? Do we always have to come to the point where somebody has to protest before we act?
It appears that's the only language we understand.
Which is bad, because then it means that somebody's not doing their work. Whose table is it on? Why is the person not taking action? Why is the person still at post after so many years? And these are questions that keep running through my mind, because if you want a smooth system, then you should have people who are there who know what they have to do and are doing what they have to do. Otherwise, we will keep going forward and coming backward and going forward and coming backward. Fine, there was an explosion in, was it the one in Atomic?
Yes.
The one at Atomic Junction?
Yes.
So there was that explosion. So you needed to ensure that all these people were complying with regulations so that you don't have a leakage that will cause that much havoc anymore. Who is going around? Who is doing the monitoring? Who is doing the evaluation? Who is going around to make sure that all these LPG stations are well protected? I remember there was one at Trade Fair even before the Atomic Junction one. And so my question was, but there was one recently. We lost very close friends and loved ones. Why are we waiting for another one to occur? Another one has occurred, and up till now, nothing has been done. So we don't know what we are doing. We are not serious with what we have to do.
Mm.
And if we are using LPG so we keep our forest, and you are not making sure that people get it and at reasonable prices, then we're
what are we doing then? Well, let's just wrap with these two stories very quickly. I'll read a number of stories, but I'll focus on two, just two, and maybe in a minute and a half we can wrap with those. The Daily Guide newspaper, NPP foot soldiers cry for reshuffle. I'll be telling you a bit about that. Daughter killer dashes to court. There's a picture here of Oliver Baka Voma, or Kumanga, as they put it here, set for High Court trial. More projects coming, Baumia assures Asanteman. There's also the Finder newspaper. SIM card registration centers empty following deadline extension, but NIA head office remains inundated. There's Japanese government donates 23 vehicles to Ghana Police Service. Yeah, this is what we know. Receiving every time. When are we also going to grow up and give? Even the Bible says it. There's more, joy. It's better to, give than receive. We're always going pan in hand. Give me, give me, give me, give me. Reminds me of a boy in Liberia, Monrovia, back then. Interesting story. Maybe I'll tell you someday, Liz. And then the Meridian NPA assists Zambia to fight fuel adulteration. Interesting. So those two stories I want you to look at. NPP foot soldiers cry for reshuffle, and the group is Alliance for Foot Soldiers Advocacy, which is appealing to President Akufo-Addo to reshuffle his ministers as a matter of urgency. Ministers, deputy ministers, CEOs, they want them reshuffled. And the finder, Japanese government donates 23 vehicles to Ghana, as well as SIM card registration centers empty following the pushing of the deadline. You can pick two and react to them in a minute, and we're off.
I'm thinking about reshuffling, and I'm wondering, when you reshuffle, it's the same ministers that you're moving around. But have we seen the ministers get A plus?
I think a reshuffle should also be able to include getting someone who is not performing out and bringing someone someone completely different in.
Exactly. But again, I am saying that have we been able to examine to know those who should stay and those who should go? If you look at the ministries that you probably deal with, is it anything to write home about? I sit and watch, and I think that there's a lot that needs to be done. Reshuffling alone it won't solve our problems. We need to build strong institutions, and if our ministries, departments, and agencies are not strong institutions, then we have a lot of work to do.
Mm.
So yes, maybe a reshuffle will help us because new ideas will be brought in and people will be able to think outside the box and become creative and do certain things differently. But we as a people should also call for certain things. Apart from reshuffling, we should make sure that our ministries are up and doing, our departments and agencies are up and doing. And I think that if we call for that and we insist that we get value for money as regards the services that we are expecting them to put out, then we'll be way ahead. We won't be dragging our feet, or we won't be crawling.
Right.
You mentioned another
SIM card registration centers. Now, the deadline has been postponed, and all of a sudden they are empty again. I guess it's a cat and mouse situation. Maybe some 20 seconds on that.
I believe that people think that now they have time, so they are not pressed. You know, people would leave anything they are doing just to go and queue to get it registered because you have a deadline, and if you don't get it done. And so people left their jobs and everything and went to queue. Now that it has been extended, I think that Ghanaians may like last minute. But I believe that over time, what I don't see is NCA and the telecos being proactive, also going out. You want people to come to your offices, but your offices are not everywhere. So if I have to leave where I work, I probably have to travel some distance to your office to be able to sit there and wait and register my SIM card.
Mm.
Can we have them move into the communities to... You say that you're in this community for a period of time and people should come and register,
right,
and have people who are dedicated to that.
Right.
I mean, just registering SIM cards rather than going into their office. Sometimes their offices are crowded.
Yeah.
And people are outside in the sun. There's nowhere for them to sit. Some of them are standing around waiting for hours on end. Can they go out and make sure that... we provide this service and see what the Ministry of Communications can do to help them.
Mm.
If people do not spend the whole day just waiting to register. If I come to register my SIM card, it will be when I think I have time
right
to do so. But maybe I